Well, Linda continues with her story of the Dragonfly drones experience right here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back with her. We'll let you get back into the second part of this strange story. Go ahead.
Right. Well, after that early morning, October 6, 2010, second encounter at the pine tree stump, also in his work site, Ted Connors began to look for the word Oltisis. It's spelled O-L-T-I-S-S-I-S. 2.5 months later, on his Monday day off of December 20th, 2010, Ted took time to explore a library. On a table were some old books to check out or purchase, and one was entitled Ancient Greek Gods and Lore Revisited, copyright 1962, by Frederico Ioannides. And for those listening who would like to help in the search for this book, all of this is at my news website, earthfiles.com, in these reports. Now, Ted checked this book out from the library, and that day he looked into the index and found three references to the word Oltisis, and found in one footnote that the word was linked strangely to historic pleasure palaces in Greece and China's Xanadu. Ted Connors put the book on the front seat of his car with the intention of reading more, but by Wednesday morning, December 22nd, 2010, the book was still in his car at 8 a.m. when his all-night shift from Tuesday to Wednesday ended. And he was surprised to receive a phone call to report to his boss's office. And here now, Ted Connors continues with what happened.
That morning, I received an urgent call just before I was to get off to report to my superior's office. When I entered my boss's office, there were two gentlemen seated just opposite his desk. My boss introduced them to me as one was with the Department of Homeland Security, the other was with the National Security Agency. The two gentlemen introduced themselves by name, showed me their identification, then proceeded to ask me about a book that I had checked out of the library. I told them the title of the book. They said, "We need to have that book." And I asked them why. The gentleman from Homeland Security said, "This is a national security matter. And are you aware of the Patriot Act?" And I said, "Well, I've heard of it." He says, "When we ask for something, we expect to get it. The Patriot Act gives us the right to have that information. And we are asking you for that book." And I again ask why. And at that point, my boss interceded, and he says, "Go get the book." So I went and got the book. I said, "How will I get the book back?" He says, "We will contact you."
Did you at any point in this discussion with Homeland Security and a National Security Agency representative sitting across from your boss, did you say, "Why would a book on Greek gods and lore revisited be of national security concern that under the Patriot Act that you can come from the government and confiscate a book that I got from the library?"
I did not ask that question, but I did think that question.
Did your boss know about your experience with the drone on June 25th, 2007?
Yes.
Did you and he talk about the context of this visit by Homeland Security and National Security Agency on December 22nd, 2010, in the context of the drone appearing at that tree at your facility and these two men from the government coming in and demanding the book Ancient Greek Gods and Lore Revisited?
No, that subject was never brought up. I didn't like it. I don't like it. I'll never like it, but I had to do it. I was, in a way, held captive, I guess you would say. I don't see where that book was a problem as far as national security, and it never was explained to me that it was.
How do you think that Homeland Security and National Security Agency even knew that you had checked out a book from the library 2 days before?
That's a good question. I have no idea. The only thing that could be was that I had been in contact with a certain individual who also does research in relationship to the drone craft mystery. I had related to him that I had a book via email the evening that I got home in relationship to the word Oltesis, and noticed that entry in the book in regards to Xanadu and pleasure palaces and things of that nature, and the word Oltesis. And so by sending that email, I feel like possibly that it was intercepted.
Right. The implication is that your email and your phones are being monitored by the United States government agencies, at least the Homeland Security and the National Security Agency. And that goes to the issue. They're taking the Dragonfly drone extremely seriously. And what is it about the Dragonfly drone technology and appearance here in the Earth in 2007 in all of these other interviews I've done with people who have seen this strange Dragonfly drone spanning 22 years? What is it that the government knows about these Dragonfly drones that they don't want anybody to know about and consider it a threat to national security?
Well, that's the question, the million-dollar question right there. I don't understand why it is. I don't understand what the secrecy is all about. I do understand the fact that my book was taken. I do understand the fact that my rights were violated.
Isaac talked about the fact that he assumed that the Dragonfly drones in May and June of 2007, at least, flickered in and out and could be photographed because someone was jamming a frequency. And the likelihood is that so much of this happened in California because China Lake and Edwards and so many sophisticated American military operations are there. And in fact, what might have happened is they may have had a eureka moment. Oh, we have found the frequency. We can now jam it, and we can now see where the Dragonfly drones from Oltesis are.
Exactly. You hit it right on the money. If they think they can discover it, then they think they can stop it. And if they think they can stop it, then that makes them very, very happy because it's going to maintain their power base and their ability to keep us in the dark.
It seems to me that all these pieces add up, that the intelligence of the Dragonfly drones, the intelligence that downloaded the information in your head only a few months ago on October 6, 2010, are linking themselves in the words that were communicated to you to Greek history and Greek civilization.
Exactly. There is a Greek connection there, and that's where the answer is going to lie. The answer is going to lie in the Greek connection. I do not know what that connection is. That's what I want to find out. I want to know where this leads, because this leads to the possibility of the ancient Greek civilization having some contact or interaction with the people that I received the message from.
And that it is possible that the so-called Greek gods of mythology could have been direct, up-close inspiration by the intelligences of Oltesis interacting directly with humans in what became the great Greek civilization.
Correct. That's what I believe actually has happened in the past, and I believe that now there's been a reintroduction or a reconnection. Or I don't know what reason, but there's some reason that they're reconnecting with us. That's where the answer, I believe, is going to lie in the drone mystery.
Why do you think that knowledge about extraterrestrial interaction and creation of the Greek civilization should be a national security threat?
Well, you have to go back again, Linda, to 9/11, even further than that, to look at how paranoid we are as a people. You have to look again at the people who are in charge, who make the decisions for us. We don't make our decisions. They make our decisions for us, and those decisions are based on their criteria.
We just pay the taxpayers' money that they misuse.
Exactly. You know, their criteria is their power and their ability to keep that power and to hold on to it. And if there's a threat, whether it's from this world or another dimension, then it's a threat. And that threat has to be stopped. they are the ones who want to maintain that control to keep it from the people. It's pure power and greed. It certainly is not for the benefit of mankind.
If the U.S. government is threatened by a 1962 book about ancient Greek gods and lore revisited, if the government's sensitivity is to the word Oltesis, described as a solar system of 23 planets somewhere in the cosmos, if this is really extraterrestrial contact from advanced intelligences in this universe, another universe, or other dimension or timeline, and the U.S. government is confiscating books because the name Oltesis is mentioned, how are we ever going to have reasonable communication with extraterrestrials?
I don't think they want us to. I think that's the whole agenda, is that we are not to know, and we are not to make contact, and we are not to be trying to figure this out, because I think they know. I think they know.
Our government knows.
I think our government knows.
That the Dragonfly drones are a probe, upload, download information technology by a very advanced intelligence in this cosmos, and that it was here in 2007. It was seen and photographed in 2007. It has been seen by other people spanning two decades. And right now, if the government is trying to erase the word Oltesis from the Earth mind, what do you think they are trying to accomplish?
That's another good question. I think that they're trying to dissuade us in any way from finding out about this, because, Linda, if there's one thing that I'm sure of at this point in time is that, and this is what I got from the message that I received, is that this is very important to mankind, not to governments, not to leaders, not to power brokers, to mankind.
And George, Ted Connors and I and a couple of other researchers would like to put out to the Coast and Earth Files audiences a general request. If you can help us look for a book that, for unknown reasons, has been confiscated in the interest of national security, and that so far, after several weeks, we still have not been able to find this book, but it is a big planet. And if anybody is listening through the international means who can look for, and I'm going to give the title and the copyright and the author again now, Ancient Greek Gods and Lore Revisited, copyright 1962. And the author, Ted, thinks that this was spelled Frederico this way, Frederico, which is leaving out an extra E in there. So Frederico, and the last name, Ioannidis, is spelled Ioannidis. We would welcome help from all over the planet to see if we can find this 1962 book so that we would all have the same right and privilege to try to read what little bit is in there about that word Oltesis. And I would also suggest to everybody listening that it is so interesting to try to do a Google search, and Oltesis just cross-references back to work that Ted, I, and a few others have done on the drones. So the very fact that he saw it in an index, three references to Oltesis, but now we can't find anything, and that the National Security Agency and Homeland Security, using the Patriot Act as the excuse for confiscating a 1962 book on Greek gods and lore, that this could possibly have national security interests, says more to me about what has happened to the United States than any of the political rhetoric on television. And you heard the mention about Isaac. Mm-hmm. Isaac played a to me, an extremely significant role in 2007. And he began in an email that Lex at Coast and I received when he said that this was his alias and that he used to work in what was called the Carrot Program in the 1980s. During my time there, I worked with a lot of the technology that is clearly at work in the recent drone strange craft sightings, most notably the language and diagram seen on the underside of each craft. Ted Connors also saw the strange symbols on the underneath of the tail of the drone that seemed to be hiding behind that southern yellow pine. Now, Isaac went on to explain that in his background of doing very sophisticated design on software and supercomputers, that he said, I'm releasing what could be called tremendously sensitive information even by today's standards. Sensitive is not necessarily synonymous with dangerous, which is why my conscience is clear as I offer this material up for the public. My government has its reasons for its continual secrecy, and I sympathize with many of them. But the truth is, I am getting old, and I'm not interested in meeting my maker one day with any more baggage than necessary. Furthermore, I put a little more faith in humanity than my former bosses do. And I think that a release of at least some of this information could help a lot more than it could hurt, especially in today's world. I would estimate that with the information contained in this letter, I could be narrowed down to one of maybe 30 to 50 people at best. So I feel reasonably secure. He goes on to describe his familiarity with the Chad Rajman and the other Big Basin and all of the photos that we have been exposed to because he worked on artifacts of a technology in a program called CARET, all caps, C-A-R-E-T. And he submitted with that letter the cover and several pages of what is called the CARET Q486 Research Report, which reads, Commercial Applications Research for Extraterrestrial Technology, and that this was housed in the Palo Alto CARET laboratory when he was there, and that this particular one that he sent with his email was dated December 1986. For those who would like to see actual photographs of this extraterrestrial technology and its resemblance to the dragonfly drones that have been seen in the skies and photographed, go to earthfiles.com. I've done 23 reports, of which three or four were specifically with Isaac and the CARET document before he disappeared off of the radar. And I consider it to be some of the most important information ever leaked. And it includes information about why the drones flicker off and on in the sky, the fact that they come with invisibility technology, neutralizing gravity or anti-gravity technology, and that the way that they put their machines together is with anti-gravity technology, so there are no rivets, no seams, and all those descriptions we've heard for years when people have been astonished by seeing glassy or metallic surfaces that did not seem to have any way that the craft was put together. If it is put
Linda,
together.
We've got to run. We'll be back in a moment. Well, next hour, it'll be conversations with Linda, but when we come back, we'll talk about her report on cold fusion. That's always fascinating. By the way, for just 25 cents or less a day, you can become a Coast Insider. Get all the information on that by going to coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us. Linda, cold fusion has been a subject that I have truly enjoyed during my years here at Coast to Coast AM, and I'm glad you're spending a little time on this today.
Right, because it seems to be breaking more and more with more and more substantive lab data that there really is a nuclear fusion effect. And to begin this story, we have to jump back 22 years ago to March 23rd, 1989, and that's when the science world was stunned when chemists Martin Fleischmann and Stanley Pons announced that they had produced deuterium nuclear fusion in a test tube that produced 4 megajoules of energy. The megajoule is equal to 1 million joules, or approximately the kinetic energy of a one-ton vehicle moving at 100 miles an hour. But they had produced, they said, 4 megajoules. That was a lot of energy. At the time, Stanley Pons, Ph.D., was chairman of the chemistry department at the University of Utah. Working with him was retired British electrochemist Martin Fleischmann, Ph.D., a fellow of the Royal Society in Great Britain, who had received the 1985 Palladium Medal from the U.S. Electrochemical Society. The two scientists originally met in England in 1975 at the University of Southampton, where Martin Fleischmann was a professor of electrochemistry and University of Michigan student Stanley Pons was completing his Ph.D. The two chemists in 1989 reported using a palladium cathode and platinum anode immersed in heavy water, all contained in a boric silicate glass. Palladium, that same metal that Ted Connors found in the pine tree where the Dragonfly drone had been, is unique among Earth elements in its ability to absorb up to 900 times its own volume of hydrogen and at room temperatures. If Pons and Fleischmann really did an electrochemical nuclear fusion experiment that could produce 4 megajoules of energy, it was a major breakthrough, and headlines around the world anticipated that cold fusion, as it was called, could eventually replace fossil fuels. But then other scientists began to attack. Their knowledge was from textbooks, not their lab at the University of Utah. And in the textbooks, it said that the byproducts of deuterium fusion would be enough neutrinos, tritium, and gamma rays to kill Fleischmann and Pons in their University of Utah lab. Since those two were alive and being interviewed on TV, the logic was they must be wrong about their experiment. Historically, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, led the academic assault against cold fusion. So it is perhaps ironic justice that this month, on June 11th to 12th, 2011, MIT provided facilities for the 2011 LANR/CF colloquium. That stands for 2011 Lattice Assisted Nuclear Reaction/Cold Fusion, the newer, more politically acceptable name for cold fusion. Some 24 researchers attended to discuss promising cold fusion experiments in Israel, Japan, Italy, and the United States now. Not 22 years ago, now. Making the 2011 MIT colloquium possible is 56-year-old Peter Hagelstein, Ph.D., Associate Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Sciences at MIT since 1986. In spite of persistent criticism of cold fusion experiments and difficulties in financing cold fusion research, Professor Hagelstein is convinced he has seen with his own eyes the energy results of electrochemical nuclear fusion and thinks cold fusion could yet be an important energy breakthrough in this 21st century that needs so much help. Here now is MIT Professor Peter Hagelstein.
The science that has been done within the community over the past 22 years, in my view, signifies very strongly that there is a real effect, that it can be understood, that it can be addressed experimentally, that it can be addressed theoretically as well. And a huge amount of progress has been made, which could provide some support, some scientific support, for the notion of the development of a technology that would be fundamental in addressing the energy problems that we're facing, addressing the climate change problems that we're facing that would address the lack of availability of clean water throughout the world. There are a number of experiments out there which I think are candidates to be exactly that kind of experiment. In this day and age, people can do cold fusion experiments and see excess heat. For example, Mitchell Swartz pretty much claims these days that in the majority of his experiments, if his cathode's in good shape and if his connections are spot welded properly and they don't break or something, that pretty much every cell that he runs produces excess power. And he can get factors of 2 or 3 pretty much every single time that he does an experiment. And he's reported an ability to get factors of 10 excess power and a few observations of even higher levels of excess power. The SRI group had a great many observations in their earlier work where they would see excess powers in the range of 10-15% up to a factor of 100% excess power. There's a group that worked in Israel under the heading of Energetics Corporation, and they managed to get rather good reproducibility for basically 100% to 200% excess heat events while they were in Israel. There's a breaking wire experiment that was reported at this symposium that's been innovated at SRI, which one version of it that involves co-deposition of palladium on a palladium wire, running it in heavy water and pulsing it, that experiment appears to work every single time that it's performed when the loading's high enough. And that is a candidate for an experiment that could be replicated more widely among the scientific community. We know that it's a real effect because many of us have been involved in experiments where we've seen it with our own eyes and instruments. Those who've persisted have seen energy from these experiments, have seen an awful lot of energy coming from these experiments. So those that have worked the longest and the hardest on this problem will tell you from their own observations that the effect is completely real, and as such would provide the basis of an area of research. Sadly, because of events that took place in 1989, an effort was made to discredit the work Pons and Fleischmann reported and to discredit the work of folks that were doing research in the area. And those involved in discrediting the research were wildly successful.
Why was there such a concerted effort to discredit this major breakthrough in cold fusion?
A wonderful question. I don't actually know the answer. I do know pieces of the answer. In 1989, when the announcement was first made, it basically went against numerous textbooks on nuclear physics and condensed matter physics. And the basic issue is that there was no previous work that had been reported which was consistent with this announcement. For example, the production of nuclear energy is, at this point, well known and well understood. But the way it works is different than what was claimed by Fleischmann and Pons. For example, Fleischmann had conjectured that in some way deuterons were coming together and fusing in his cell. However, DD fusion had been studied in nuclear physics ever since the late 1930s or so. And people know that when deuteron-deuteron fusion happens, that you get energetic reaction products. You get two pathways. You get a proton and a triton. You get a neutron and helium-3. And the two pathways, primary pathways, happen 50-50. So in association with fusion energy, deuteron-deuteron fusion energy, you'd expect roughly a little bit less than half of your energy to come out through the neutron plus helium-3 pathway. And the neutrons, there's a lot of neutrons, and they carry a lot of energy. So Fleischmann and Pons talk about nuclear fusion in their cell. If they produced watt levels of excess power, they would have been pretty badly posed by a flux of neutrons, which would have done them in. And given that they hadn't been done in, the physicists knew that they had not seen fusion of the kind that had been studied and was discussed in papers and textbooks. Everybody was uncertain as to whether Fleischmann-Pons were right or not. And given that they were claiming an effect that was, you know, fusion in a test tube, where fusion was known not to occur in a test tube, most physicists thought they were just wrong. You had chaos reigning. You had everybody trying experiments without enough information to do a confirmation experiment.
Well, Professor Hagelstein, if you and your younger colleagues have been able to demonstrate that the palladium and platinum in heavy water does produce energy, then why would there be any negative hangover from years ago in 1989 when Martin Fleischmann and Stan Pons were falsely criticized? And 21 years later, you and the colloquium are basically saying the idea has been vindicated. So why wouldn't that release resources in a country like the United States that needs an energy alternative to fossil fuels so badly?
A wonderful question. I do not know the answer to your question. I know bits and pieces of the answer to your question, but I don't know the answer in general. In order to get funding in this day and age, you need to basically have support of your fellow scientists. You send in a proposal, it goes out to get reviewed, and you need to make sure that in some way the people that review it know what you're working on and think highly of it and are willing to recommend that it be supported. That's not the case for work in the cold fusion business.
And yet it could be the answer to our huge energy problem.
It looks like it could be an answer to some of the hardest problems that the world's facing at the moment. And I hope and I believe that it will lead to a technology that will solve the world's problems. But I don't think anyone could say that with 100% certainty today. What I do know is that this is an area where experiments have been done that are very important, which are not making it out to the mainstream. Mainstream scientists are not interested in this area. They do not take the time to find out what experiments have been done in the field. They do not spend time thinking about what the impact or implications of these experiments are. I don't see anything that's going to change that anytime in the near future.
Except desperation of a planet that is becoming too hot in some places, too dry in others. The climate is changing. Fossil fuels are running out. And how do we get from the beginning of the 21st century to the end of the 21st century without some really substantive, viable alternative to fossil fuels?
I think this area is an area which could produce exactly the viable alternative that would make the biggest difference.
Would be nice, Linda, wouldn't it?
Well, something has to happen. We are running out of fossil fuels. The planet is changing drastically in the climate. And the idea that cold fusion has supporters now that are very excited about the energy that they are being able to get out of an electrochemical process at a nuclear fusion level is exciting to me. It's exciting to them because we need something like this so desperately. And 6 months ago in January, there is a scientist in Italy named Andrea Rossi, and he demonstrated a device that he calls an energy catalyzer, or the ECAT. And he purports that he can develop 10 kilowatts of power from an electrochemical nuclear reaction. And then, just recently, on June 23rd of this month, Andrea Rossi announced at a press conference in a suburb of Athens that he now has a contract for 2 years to develop his ECAT further at the University of Bologna in Italy. And then you combine Italy, and that there is are different progresses being made in Japan and in the United States with what happened and was announced in Israel a couple of years ago. And this came from scientists at the U.S. Navy's San Diego. It's called the Space and Naval Warfare Systems Center, or SPAWAR. And they have put out a press release and a press conference that they have produced what they called as something unique in the 17-year history of trying to develop cold fusion. And that was the way they described it, that they now have a simple, portable, highly repeatable, unambiguous, and permanent physical evidence of nuclear events using detectors that have a long track record of reliability and acceptance among nuclear physicists. Bottom line, in the Pons-Fleischmann work, they were immediately criticized for, one, being off the radar in terms of what was known in textbooks, but they had not published before that announcement. And when people ran into the problem that they couldn't reproduce that work, then cold fusion had this kind of taint, this sourness that it was not reproducible. And what I think is so important about this work that was announced 2 years ago by the U.S. Navy Laboratory is that they are showing, and at Earth Files, I have one of their photographs. And this is three tracks in a nuclear track detector that the scientists say is caused by high-energy nuclear particles that resulted from a nuclear reaction. George, this is hard evidence coming from scientists in the Department of Navy that there's nuclear fusion going on inside of their test tube device, and that they are consequently getting out more energy than they are putting in. And that is the whole essence of the idea that you could have nuclear fusion, say deuterium, deuterium fusion, and that you would put in X amount of energy, and that on the other side, because of this combination of the, in the beginning, it was palladium, and now they're trying to do it with something that is more common, like nickel or copper or other metals that are cheaper, but that they would get out so much more energy, up to 200%, in one of the Israeli experiments. So right now, as I see, and I'm going to continue to try to learn more and interview more scientists who are working on cold fusion, that this could be, around the corner, the biggest breakthrough for giving lots of energy to a planet that needs it, and that it would be clean. And this is the holy grail, isn't it, of what we would all like to see happen.
That's what we've been looking for. You remember the late Eugene Maloff. It was his life, wasn't it?
Yes, and my heart goes out to Dr. Pons and Dr. Fleischmann for being ahead of their time and being attacked when 22 years later, I think they're being vindicated.
Linda, when we come back, we'll have conversations with Linda Moulton Howe and, of course, her website, earthfiles.com. You can send her an email at earthfiles@earthfiles.com as well. Back in a moment with your calls on Coast to Coast AM.